From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The president of Turkey is in Russia today, his first foreign meeting since surviving that attempted coup last month. President Erdogan and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin held a press conference in St. Petersburg. Erdogan said Putin was among the first leaders to call after the failed coup and that a natural gas pipeline with Russia and a deal to build Turkey's first nuclear power plant would be restarted. In November, Turkey shot down a Russian jet near the Syrian border. Russia responded with painful economic sanctions against Turkey. In June, Erdogan apologized, setting the stage for today's meeting. But what does it mean? The BBC's Mark Lowen is in Istanbul. And Mark, what does each country need from the other?
Well, one of the areas Turkey needs Russia is energy. Over half of Turkish energy is imported from Russia, gas and other forms of energy. And so two leaders have been discussing the so-called Turk Stream project, which is a project to pump Russian gas to Europe via Turkey, bypassing Ukraine. They've also been discussing a Russian-funded nuclear power plant in Turkey. So these are areas where they cooperate. There are clearly areas where they don't cooperate as well, and it's thought that they've been largely glossed over. Areas like Syria, where the two leaders back opposing sides in the Syrian war, and Ukraine as well, where Turkey has opposed Russia's actions in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea as well. But what this comes down to, effectively, is a symbolic meeting. It is a rapprochement between two leaders whose relations had soured hugely last November. And Turkey is reaching out to Russia at a time that its relations with the West are severely strained at the moment.
We'll talk about that, because after the coup attempt in Turkey last month, Erdogan cracked down on political opponents, journalists, academics, of course, members of the military, people, anyone he accused of plotting against him, thousands. Vladimir Putin did not criticize those tactics. So what might the EU and the U.S. make of a maybe even new, stronger alliance between these two leaders?
Well, to some extent, Turkey has always sort of oscillated between the two sides in any case. I mean, it is a strong NATO ally. It's got the second largest army in NATO. It is a candidate for EU membership, but it traditionally placed importance on the relationship with Russia as well. Russia is largely in the same neighborhood. The two countries have an important relationship, and to some extent also they're very similar leaders. I mean, these are two strongmen leaders, often criticized for being authoritarian, not having much time for niceties like freedom of the press, and they need each other since they don't have many other allies in the rest of the world. In terms of how the West is going to react to this Turkey-Russia relationship, well, I think that there will be some frustration that the relationship with Turkey is rather soured at the moment, because Western leaders did condemn the coup, Western leaders feel that they were justified in speaking out about the wave of arrests and the purge that has followed. The Turkish government simply doesn't see it that way. They feel frustrated by the fact that no Western leader has come to Turkey in the wake of the failed coup, and that really their focus has very much been on the crackdown, post-coup crackdown, rather than kind of showing strong solidarity with the Turkish government for resisting the coup.
Well, look, the talks were in the works for a while, but as part of this meeting then, Erdogan saying to everyone else, oh yeah, I can have a friend in Vladimir Putin.
I think so. This is sort of thumbing his nose at the West. Of course, the relationship with the US is very fraught at the moment, principally because the alleged mastermind of the coup attempt, Fethullah Gulen, this Islamic cleric, has been living in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania since 1999. And while Turkey's insisting on his arrest and extradition, the US government is saying, well, show us some evidence before we contemplate that. So it's a very big bone of contention at the moment between Washington and Ankara. And what the Turkish president is saying is that Vladimir Putin called him very soon after the coup attempt and showed unequivocal support. So he is basically saying, well, if the West won't stand with us at the moment, well, Vladimir Putin will.
That's the BBC's Turkey correspondent Mark Lowen speaking with us from Istanbul. Mark, thank you.
Pleasure.
Well, Donald Trump is campaigning in North Carolina today, in Wilmington and Fayetteville, after his big economic speech yesterday, in which he talked a lot about the energy industry.
A Trump administration will end this war on the American worker and unleash an energy revolution that will bring vast new wealth to our country.
Professor Michael Weber is Deputy Director at the Energy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. He joins us now. Welcome.
Great. Thank you very much.
And when you heard him say that he wants to unleash an energy revolution, some would say we're already in an energy revolution right now.
Yeah, that was my first thought, is maybe he missed the news that the energy revolution has already happened and is still underway, in fact. And so I wondered what would be new to this revolution.
Well, and give us a sense of what the revolution that's going on right now looks like. What parts of the energy industry are benefiting? Because obviously he would say, well, coal is not in an energy revolution.
Yeah, the energy revolution we've experienced for the last 6-7 years has really been transformative across the entire energy sector with a lot of winners. We've got a lot of production in oil and gas that's up, a lot of production of wind and solar that's up, and coal is down. So coal hasn't been one of the winners in the last few years, but we have a lot of other winners and a lot of success. And the good news is it means we're making more money for energy. Our energy is cheaper, and we're actually even exporting more energy than we used to.
And what about his call for lifting regulations? I want to talk about what that would mean in a few minutes. But first of all, how burdensome are the regulations on the energy industry right now?
The energy industry is really heavily regulated. There are regulations at every step along the way, from the place where we take the fuels out of the ground to where it's refined, moved, burned, used. And that is a burden. It costs a lot of money. But it also protects our air and water, so it has all these public health and other ecosystem benefits. According to the Bush administration, about a decade ago, they did an assessment of the Clean Air Act, for example, and concluded that dealing with acid rain had a 40-to-1 benefit-to-cost ratio, which meant for every dollar of cost from regulatory burden, there's about $40 of benefits for public health effects and reduce asthma and that kind of thing.
But is there one regulation that you can think of that critics of all the regulation would point to and say, this doesn't make any sense, and you would agree?
There's lots of silly regulations out there, so we can find a long history of examples in the energy world of sort of boneheaded or not really thoughtful regulations. I tend to think the ones that are mandates are the ones that we find most embarrassing later on, where the government says we must use a certain type of energy or we cannot use a certain type of energy. So I find those mandates and prohibitions the most silly looking backwards.
Let's listen to a little more from Donald Trump's speech yesterday. He talked a lot about regulations, and he said he wants to end the president's regulations on coal plants, the EPA's regulations on coal plants. Let's listen.
According to the Institute for Energy Research, lifting the restrictions on all sources of American energy will do the following: increase GDP by more than $100 billion annually, add over 500,000 new jobs annually, and increase annual wages by more than $30 billion over the next 7 years.
First of all, what's your reaction to those numbers that he just cited there? And secondly, what would the cost be of lifting those regulations on public safety?
Yeah, the challenge is a lot of these numbers tend to have one part of the story. So, yeah, you could lift regulatory costs in one place, but then you have some health care or other public health burden somewhere else. In general, the war on coal, so to speak, or these regulations around coal really are just now coming into effect at the very end of the Obama administration. Most of the regulations we're dealing with coal around air emissions were from the Bush administrations, George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush, dealing with things like precursors to acid rain and smog formation and mercury emissions. What people tend to think about with the Obama administration are carbon dioxide regulations, which haven't really even taken effect yet. So a lot of the things that coal is suffering from in terms of regulatory burden are from regulatory burdens placed upon them by Republican presidents trying to deal with the public health impacts of coal. Most of the coal's economic suffering these days is actually from cheap natural gas, not the regulations, although there are more regulations looming.
And what about his comments on the coal industry and putting coal miners back to work? Is that ever likely to happen, that coal miners who are being put out of work are going to go back to work doing the same thing they were doing before?
If we look at the history of the coal mining world, it has suffered job losses many times. It is a commodity and therefore goes through boom and bust cycles just like every other commodity. If we look over the last 7 years, there's been over 30,000 jobs lost from coal, which is pretty devastating. Until you compare that to what happened in the last 4 years of the Reagan administration and the George H.W. Bush administration, over those 8 years, 65,000 jobs were lost. So the last 8 years of those Republican administrations saw more job losses in coal than in the last 7 years of the Obama administration. And that's because job losses in coal are a part of its story. the latest wave feels even more brutal because it seems like coal might not come back. At least that's the concern. And it might not, because coal is dirtier than the others. And so for coal to come back requires a lot of innovation to make sure coal is cleaner. And some of those innovations exist but are pretty expensive. It's just easier to use wind and solar and natural gas instead. So there are some serious job losses. It's hard for me to imagine a president bringing those jobs back without doing some major intervention in the markets, which in general is surprising to hear from a Republican candidate, because Republicans generally are the party that doesn't want to meddle in the markets just to protect very particular technologies or companies.
That's Professor Michael Weber, a deputy director at the Energy Institute at the University of Texas, Austin. He's also author of Thirst for Power, Energy, Water, and Human Survival. Professor, thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
2016 has been a great year for singer-songwriter Lori McKenna. Her song Girl Crush, which Little Big Town recorded, won a Grammy for Best Country Song.
I got a girl crush, hate to admit it, but I got a heart rush, it's slowing down.
Tim McGraw's version of Lori's Humble and Kind topped Billboard's list of hot country songs.
Go to church cause your mama's sister. Visit grandpa every chance that you can. It won't be wasted time. Always stay humble and kind.
And now Lori McKenna has her own new album, The Bird and the Rifle. It's her 10th. Here's the lead track, Wreck You.
I don't know how to pull you back. I don't know how to pull you close. All I know is how to wreck you. Something between us changed. I'm not sure if it's you or me. But lately all I do seems to wreck.
That's Wreck You off of Lori McKenna's new album, The Bird and the Rifle. So it's been a great year. Also, it's been a great life, one that's almost a joke in country music circles. She fell in love with a boy in third grade, married him when she was 19. He works for a plumbing company. They now have 5 kids, and her success drove them to really move up in the world. They bought a new house in the town that they grew up in and where their families live, Stoughton, Massachusetts. And Lori McKenna joins us in the studio. Yay!
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's just great. And great. It's been great to watch you. You went on Oprah with Faith Hill, who covered your songs. Everyone cried. Have you gotten used to this?
I think we have, like my family, in a lot of ways we have. And it's really, you know, changed us in the way that music is a bigger part of our lives than it probably would have been if I was just making records on my own. Right. You know, I have writers come to the house a lot, and we travel more.
And it's a bigger house.
Yeah, and it's a bigger house.
It's not with your dad anymore. I moved out of there. But then we have the song on your new CD, Giving Up on Your Hometown. Wait, I mean, you live in your hometown. Let's just listen to a little. What? I mean, you know, I don't know if you're going to allow this to be played in Stoughton. What? Your family and many ghosts. I mean, your mom died when you were very young.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in that one place. What are you saying?
It's really just about, you know, the changes that you see. When you stay this long in a town, you see the changes, and maybe you don't like them all. And mm-hmm. just that whole nostalgia, like going back to your home, even though you're right there, you know, so it's still the change.
Yeah, maybe you're saying give up on it not changing, but stay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned the kids. I mean, you've told us before, you're very much a mom.
That's like the first thing, right? As soon as
five
that happens,
kids.
You have to be a mom first.
Yeah.
And they've been really good. They really have embraced, you know, my job. And they're a big part of it. You know, they inspire the writing. They inspire what travel happens and what travel doesn't. And and it's them, you know, it's all about them.
Well, we're going to hear a song that really might be about them. But first, we just heard Wreck You, and there's another song, If Whiskey Were a Woman. You're in a fantastic marriage since you were 19. Where do those songs come from?
As a songwriter, you just have to take an emotion that you felt for like 10 minutes you know, like whether it's despair or happiness, and you have to just like exaggerate it. You just have to blow it up to 3.5 minutes and put some lyrics with it.
If the sunrise was a woman, she would surround you with salvation and get you standing right up off your knees. If whiskey were a woman, she'd be nothing like me.
And Laurie McKenna, again, we're talking to Laurie McKenna. She's got a new album, The Bird and the Rifle. Can we hear a little of The Bird and the Rifle? What inspired this?
This song is so funny because it was inspired by a joke on the TV show Modern Family. It was a scene where the mom, who I think is Claire, was taking her daughter Haley for a drink as Haley had turned 21. And the step-grandmother, who's Gloria, was there as well. And they were talking about things that moms and daughters can do together. They mentioned tattoos. They could get matching tattoos. And someone said the moon and the stars. And then Gloria said the bird and the rifle. And so it was like this punchline that came from, you know, like this love or this, you know, like holding back. And I just loved it. And I knew immediately like it could be, you know, a relationship.
You've got your guitar there. So let's listen to a little of it.
Well, the bird is always dreaming out the window, looking at that big wide open sky. And the rifle, he used to be a dreamer, but he wasn't meant to fly. Something down on the ground won't let her out, it holds her in. He's afraid if she flies, she'll never come home again. Something about the bird in her, spreading those wings, always brings a rifle out in him.
You know, Laurie McKenna, you've spoken quite a bit about, you know, your mom dying at a young age. Very sad. And I'm just wondering, first of all, is she still somehow with you through your songwriting?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. It's I think that might be why I'm a songwriter. I think that's I have brothers that are songwriters too, and I think, you know, that has something to do with it. Like giving up on your hometown mentions my mom, and it's funny because I gave the CD to my sister yesterday, my niece, to give to my sister yesterday. I said, you got to warn her about giving up on your hometown. It mentions mom, mentions Nana. You know, it just it's impossible for it not to come through. There's also a song on the record called Always Want You, which seems like a love song. I wrote it with Liz Rose and Hillary Lindsay, who I wrote Girl Crush with. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it is it's a love song. But to me, it really is where I got that feeling from, was sort of like always wanting, you know, always missing her, you know, rather than not because, you know, a man, yeah.
It never stops like the hands of a clock. I just circle around like they do. Yeah, I think I'll always want you.
So it's funny, because then you can just take that emotion and sort of shape it the way you want it to be shaped in the song.
I wonder if that's why you stay in Stoughton, too.
It's funny. I did realize that this year. It's like I'm waiting for like a resurrection or something. I think that has a lot to do with it.
Oh, yeah. I was afraid. I didn't want to move at one point from New York down to Washington, and I realized, what's going on?
Yeah.
Well, my father's grave was there.
Right.
You know, so. Yeah, it's hard.
No, it is. It's true.
Well, but you seem to be, I don't know, maybe your mom might be living in your music, but maybe she's also living through you in some of the thoughts you're passing down. As we heard, Tim McGraw recorded You're Humble and Kind. You've got your guitar. We want to hear. Let's listen to a little first of Humble and Kind.
Hold the door, say please, say thank you. Don't steal, don't cheat, and don't lie. I know you got mountains to climb, but always stay humble and kind. When those dreams that you're dreaming come to you,
can we presume this was to your kids?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's funny. Our kids are 27 to 12, you know, this, and they're all over the place. You know, everyone's doing a different thing. And I just was thinking about, like, oh, man, what am I going to get accused of not telling them when they get older? And it was really just making a list of things that I wanted to be sure that they knew from my mouth, you know. Mm. And really, it could have gone on and on and on. And it was just a matter of sort of distilling it down to where it is.
Yeah. It's lovely, but made even more so because, again, I'm wondering, you know, you're conscious that maybe more than most, of the fact that you may not be able to tell them everything because your mom, you know, left so early.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. It's like, and you just, everybody's so busy. And it's like, do you remind them, like, the little things? And then it's funny because when Tim recorded it, it'd be on the radio sometimes. And then it would be like, it was reminding me of, like, to calm down, you know, when you're driving or whatever. And it's funny. It's like, I think we all need to remind, it's like saying a prayer in a way. It's like you need to remind yourself sometimes of just, like, the most basic thing.
Yeah. Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Lori McKenna. Her new album is The Bird and the Rifle. Lori, just always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
A 7-day, 155-mile race through China's Gobi Desert has changed the life of an ultra-marathon runner from Scotland. And it's not only because he crossed the finish line. It's what he crossed the finish line with. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports.
When you're running 150 miles over sand dune mountains under a sun that superheats the air, God knows you need a distraction.
I saw her around the campsite in the evening.
Dion Leonard didn't think much about his desert siren at first. He's run ultramarathons in some of the most inhospitable places on Earth. What's the big deal about a stray dog in the Chinese outback?
It wasn't until day two that she was actually at my side, and she was at the start line looking up at me as we were about to set off, and I thought to myself, this little dog's not going to run, surely.
Surely not with 100 competitors stacked up behind her.
I thought, I hope she's quick. And
she was.
We set off and she raced ahead. So I was really under pressure to keep up with her for a little while.
Leonard can't say why the tiny sand-colored mutt picked him, but the pair ran together that day, up a mountain pass and down the other side of the Gobi Desert Range. She'd run ahead for a while, then circle back to nip at his heels.
She'd nip on my gaiters, and the gaiters are the sort of shoe covers that we use to keep the sand and the rocks out. And she'd nip at those, and as if to say, come on, let's go quicker, let's go quicker.
At night, they kept warm in Leonard's tent. He gave her water and food, and the next day, they started out again.
You know, on day three, it was really cemented when I realized that I go to these races to compete, yet here I am actually carrying this little dog across these river crossings and water bridge gates that she wouldn't be able to cross on her own. I'm kind of sacrificing my time and my placing by doing this, and I realized that it was more than just a bond.
Leonard says there's a lot of time to think in the desert about the direction life is heading. And this little dog in the Gobi became a kind of symbol, proof the world isn't always such a barren place. But on day four, the heat started cranking, 125 soul-melting degrees.
It's pretty grim.
You struggle to sleep at night.
You struggle to eat when it gets warm. And it puts a lot of pressure on you then.
The race directors wouldn't let the dog run in that heat, so they put her in a car and drove her to the end of the line. And what do you know? That's where she was waiting.
Yeah, I had a lot of time to sort of think about her and think about what she was doing during those days. But as I get into the finish line, she's there at the finish line. She's where the checkpoint and the timing staff are, calculating people coming in. And she would actually get up as soon as she saw me. Running in, and she'd meet me and then run in together with me. And Yeah, again, that was just one of those little moments that I was just like, wow, this is an incredible dog.
I asked Leonard, maybe the dog was just hungry and you gave her food. Maybe the dog was cold and you let her sleep in the stinky, warm pit of your arm. Maybe that's why she followed you 77 miles through the desert. Did that ever cross your mind?
No, it never did, to be honest. It didn't. It just...
There was just more to it. Today, Leonard is back home in Scotland. The dog is in China. Race organizers are keeping her safe, though she's a free spirit, and who knows if they can keep her contained for long. Leonard has raised more than $8,000 to adopt her. Getting through quarantine is expensive. Meanwhile, he's given the little stray beast a name. It's Gobi. What else? For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Ohio is the epicenter of the fentanyl crisis, fentanyl being the cheap, deadly drug that dealers sell as heroin. Last month, the government called it an unprecedented threat. And last year, it took DJ Shank's life, even though he and his family had never heard of it. His is a story of a desperate, caring family, a failed health and justice system, and thanks to a security camera, it's a story of what an overdose looks like, as undignified as the disease of addiction itself. David Armstrong is with STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication, and our weekly partner. He and the STAT team tell the story of DJ Shanks and Justin Laycock. They met in kindergarten in Swanton, Ohio, outside Toledo. Later went from cigarettes to marijuana to pain pills to heroin. But they were good kids. David, tell us more. Who were they?
DJ and Justin were two regular kids growing up in a small middle American town. They were very well-rounded kids. DJ was a very good athlete, baseball, football player. But when he entered high school, he was also in the show choir. He was a thespian who acted in plays. Justin was a runner. He also had an interest in broadcasting. And it really wasn't until end of their sophomore year that they began to experiment with drugs.
It's stunning how often DJ in particular tries to clean up, but he can't get into facilities because he's not sick enough.
This happened to both of them. Justin tells a story where he finally decides he needs help. He goes to a treatment center. They test his urine and say, we don't see any drugs in your system. And this was a young man who was using heroin every day. So he literally walked out the treatment center door, found his drug dealer, used heroin, went back so that he could get admitted.
And DJ kept a journal. And here his mom, Angela, because DJ is, of course, the one who passed. Here his mom, Angela, reads an excerpt about one of the times he was clean.
I've never been so happy in my life now that I am finally clean. I can now think straight. I have good goals set ahead for me. I want my parents to be able to trust me again and not have to worry about me stealing things. I really want to be done with this drug.
He goes on to say, I can't believe I stole from my mother and father. They were both stealing from their families. But what's clear is the families were desperately intervening to try to stop them.
They were. The families really were at a loss as to what to do. And in one sort of dramatic scene, DJ's family is so desperate to get him help that they actually set him up to get arrested. They alert police that he's been stealing from them and that he's going to be coming to their house at a certain time. And the police are waiting on the road outside. And when they pull him over, they find some baggies, one of which had a trace of heroin. And this results in DJ going to jail. But for the family, it was a relief. They knew he was going to be in an environment where it would be at least much harder to get heroin. And he does get clean and off drugs for almost a year after this.
Well, then we come to the point where DJ's working in a donut shop. His girlfriend actually goes there to do her homework to keep an eye on him.
She would sit while he was working, and other family members similarly kept an eye on DJ. This was at a point where he had relapsed, and they were terrified.
And part of that was keeping him away from Justin, because Justin, they knew, you know, might supply him with drugs. And this takes us to how desperate an addict is for the drug. There's something called dope sickness, and it happened one day to DJ. What is that?
Well, dope sickness is when your body gets accustomed to a certain level of the opioid or a certain level of heroin. And when it's not getting that amount of the drug, it starts to retaliate. And every addict I've talked to Fear is dope sickness more than anything in the world, you know, and causes intense pain throughout your body, cramping, vomiting, diarrhea. Yeah. And on this particular day, DJ sent Justin a note and told him he was getting dope sick.
Justin brings what he thinks is heroin, gives it to DJ, and here's where there is this terrible security camera video. We watch DJ, well, you describe it.
Yeah, it's really haunting, I think, to watch what happens to DJ. He starts to itch and wipe his face. This is a side effect of opioids. And then he's standing over the glaze counter where he was a baker at this Tim Hortons restaurant in Toledo. And he slowly, very slowly, almost like he's attached to a winch, starts to lower his upper half of his body over the counter. And for almost a minute, he just slowly slinks forward until his head comes to rest on the counter. And we now know this is where he dies.
Yeah, as workers, lays there. As co-workers move around him.
A co-worker for essentially a half an hour realizes he's in distress, a couple of times pats him on the back and tries to shake him and wake him up, but continues to do her job. She's the only other one in the store and literally is putting donuts in an oven above his head while he is passed out or perhaps dead at this point.
Yeah. She later said that she just didn't know what to do. Well, the coroner later finds out that this is fentanyl, the powerful drug that we talked about. And Justin Lakoff says he didn't know that's what he gave his friend. He thought he was helping somebody with dope sickness. Let's listen.
I didn't know it was fentanyl. I didn't know what fentanyl was. And I still kind of barely know what it is. I just know that it's strong enough that a little bit killed my best friend.
Well, and now we come to, after the death of DJ, what happens to Justin? He admits he gives a drug to his friend, doesn't know it's fentanyl. He says he did it to help him with the dope sickness. The judge was somewhat sympathetic. This is Lucas County Common Pleas Court Judge Ian English. Let's listen.
I tried to do the right thing. This wasn't a crime of profit. This wasn't a crime of passion. This was one drug addicted person helping another drug addicted person avoid becoming what we call dope sick.
But David Armstrong, again from STAT, which reported this story, I can hear someone saying, that's not somebody helping a drug-addicted person. That's somebody feeding somebody's addiction. But in any event, that's what the judge felt. What did Justin Laycock have to do in order to get help? What happened?
Well, this is a pretty amazing situation, and there's a term used that I had never heard of, and that is pleading up. We hear about people pleading down as part of agreements to admit guilt in a case. But in this case, to get help, Justin Laycock actually pled to a more serious charge of manslaughter instead of a charge of corrupting another with drugs. So in essence, he had to admit in court that he killed his best friend. And the reason he did that, it was the only way the judge could craft a sentence that mandated he gets treatment,
right,
and followed by a period of probation where he's drug tested and monitored and somebody's keeping an eye on him.
Because if he had just been charged with giving someone drugs, he would not have been allowed to get drug treatment.
It was a mandatory prison sentence. You serve this amount of time, you get out.
Without treatment. And by saying that he killed someone, which is going to be on his record forever, he is allowed to then be committed to drug treatment. It sounds so backwards.
It is, and the judge told us that when we interviewed him after he sentenced Justin. He said these old ways with these mandatory drug charges and the sentences that come with them don't work. We need to get these people help. And he came up with this idea. It was the judge who brought the prosecutor and Justin's lawyer together and said, look, this is the only way I can get this young man help. And that's really sort of an indictment of the system.
Yeah. David Armstrong, again, senior enterprise reporter for STAT. It's a story about so many things. It's about fentanyl, which is making its way into the heroin addiction story. It's about the lack of treatment. It's about problems with the justice system. What's your takeaway?
My takeaway is how difficult it is to really address this problem. One of the things that sticks with me most from this story is when my colleague and I met or interviewed Judge English, we were packing up our gear, and I just turned to him and said, well, do you think you'll see Justin in your courtroom again? And he didn't hesitate. He said, yes, he's going to get out of jail. The people he did heroin with will find him, and he'll be back. And that just took me aback, because here's the man that just gave this young man the best chance he's had in years to do something right, but who sees what happens every day and how hard it is to address this problem and get people treatment that works.
That's David Armstrong. He led a team of reporters from STAT to tell the story. It's called Dope Sick, a harrowing story of best friend's addiction and a stealth killer. We'll link you to it and that incredible video. David, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Hulu is making some changes. After a decade offering free streaming of movies and television, the company says no longer. It will move exclusively to its premium subscription service, something more like Netflix. So is free online TV dead? Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. He joins us now. Ed, welcome back.
Thanks.
Well, explain what's happening here at Hulu.
Well, Hulu, as for those who may not know, is a sort of a streaming TV service where you get to watch shows from, you know, the major networks like NBC and ABC and Fox. And for when it launched years ago, the idea was you could now watch your shows, your favorite shows, network shows online for free. And, you know, it was ad supported. So just the way that you would, you know, watch regular television, network television, which is free to air, supported by advertising. This was the same thing, except it's online.
And several days later, right? I mean, you would be able to see it.
Several days later. Exactly. That was a key aspect to it. But they're getting rid of that part of the service. So from going forward, you will have to pay for Hulu service. And, you know, similar to like what Netflix is, at least in terms of a payment model, every month payment model.
But when it comes to Netflix, you've got a lot of original programming that people subscribe in order to get. Is Hulu going to have to boost its original programming to compete?
Yeah, it absolutely will. That's definitely the name of the game for any online streaming service, especially because a lot of the content that these guys had, at least at the outset, were the same kinds of content you get elsewhere now. So in order to compete against each other, you have to have originals that, you know, that other people won't have, which is really what HBO sort of figured out decades ago, right?
Yeah.
Which is why you have very popular HBO originals now.
So is free online TV dead, or will people be able to find it elsewhere?
It's dead. It's effectively dead. And what I mean by that is, you know, we should define our terms. I mean, television, in at least in the terms of the way we think of it, right? What we see on network TV or cable TV, you're going to have to pay to get that stuff no matter what going forward. Of course, there's still YouTube and all other kinds of sort of services out there that have free video and that could consider entertainment. Those things are free. But the TV stuff we're used to seeing, you're going to have to pay for. And that's because the TV programmers, the companies that produce them, are sort of locking you into a certain system, you know, economic system, where you have to pay for things and in some cases pay for things as well as watch commercials.
How big is Hulu compared to Netflix at this point?
So it's much smaller. And maybe a few months ago, it announced it had about 12 million paying subscribers. And I think probably now it's 13 million plus. Netflix has about 47 million, 48 million in the U.S. paying subscribers or subscribers. And so it the yards difference, right? But again, Hulu is building up its services as well as its original programming. So there's a good chance that they'll be able to get more subscribers to come in.
I want to ask you about something else that is going on in the world of tech. Many Instagram users may notice or may have noticed that there's this new feature on there that looks very much like Snapchat. What's going on there?
Right. So Instagram unveiled a new feature called Snapchat Stories, which, interestingly enough, is a similar feature or almost exactly the same feature you find in Snapchat called Snapchat Stories. And what it really is it lets users create and share videos. And they're about 10 seconds long. And they tend to be more raw looking, but that's basically it. It doesn't seem like that huge of a thing, but it the fact that they named it the same thing and has the same exact functionality and even some of the icons look very much the same is interesting. They're copying it, basically.
Why is that such a popular thing? You're basically taking a picture. Maybe you're turning it into a short video, but adding like words or putting a little piece of clip art on the bottom of it or whatever.
Right. Exactly. I don't personally quite get it, frankly, but it's very popular with the young people. And, you know, Snapchat just started as a way to sort of a pithy way to sort of communicate with your friends. It's turned into something bigger. It has video. It has a lot more things going on with it. It's more raw. And I think there's a certain authenticity or at least perceived authenticity to content that looks like that, which is what people like about it. Whereas Instagram is a far more kind of curated thing, I guess you want to call it. The pictures are much more beautiful. They're much more sort of set up in a way. So it's a really different feeling between the two. And I think for younger folks, at least, they gravitate towards Snapchat because of the sense of authenticity, I guess.
Does it surprise you, though, that Instagram, which has its own thing going on and is very popular just doing what it has been doing, would want to copy one of its competitors like that instead of just saying, we're going to do what we do well?
Well, it's always a race for the next demographic, right? The younger people, because that's where your future is going to come in. And they don't want to lose that ability. Also, even for its regular existing users on Instagram, they're just sharing less, right? So they've noticed that happening and they figured we need to do something to get people be more active on the service. Something like Snapchat with disappearing messages and disappearing videos, it feels more urgent, right? You have to always be checking out those. You're going to miss something. And I think that's another factor in why Instagram sort of updated or added this part of the features.
And you think Snapchat's worried?
They definitely are worried because Instagram still has many, many more users. It's owned by Facebook. They've got deep pockets. And, you know, they could very well steal their thunder with this.
That's Ed Lee, a managing editor at Recode, talking with us about Instagram and before that, Hulu, both rolling out some big changes. Ed, thanks so much.
Anytime.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. We're definitely on Facebook. We're definitely on Twitter. I don't know if we're on Snapchat. We would be so lame and old if we were not on Snapchat. We should get on there. We are on Instagram, by the way. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.